Go ahead with the question.
No particular question, just simply if you could review, because it's been quite a few weeks. Yes, thank
okay.
you.
So we are on Daf Yud Amud Beis, and we happen to be up to, in the medium width lines on Yud Amud Beis, we are up to Nasena Aliyas Kir Kitano. It's the third to last medium width line, the second word on the lines, right after the two dots. The Gemara until now had been talking about Chizkiya HaMelech, which in itself was something of a tangent. And the last thing the Gemara had spoken about, I mean, the reason why Chizkiya is here is because Chizkiya says to God when he's sick and he turns to God to save him and says, I did what was good in your eyes. So the Gemara says he was so mechgula l'tfila. So once we're on Chizkiya, we talk about Chizkiya's salvation. And the last thing the Gemara had said was that Chizkiya prayed to God and he turned to the kir, to the wall. And what does it mean that he turned to the kir? So the Gemara says that Chizkiya was making reference to other usages of the word kir in Tanakh, specifically the Shunamis, who only made one wall for Elisha Hanavi, and yet God revived her son from the dead. So my ancestor David, who made all the walls of the Beis HaMikdash, certainly you should save me. Okay, so the Gemara spoke about Chizkiya, but here now the Gemara turns its attention back to that story of the Isha Hashunamis, who made some type of addition to her home in order to accommodate Elisha, who regularly passed by. So the Gemara says the following, Nasena Aliyas Kir Kitano. Rav Shmuel, there's a machlokas between Rav and Shmuel what this means. Charamar, Aliyah Perua Haisa Vikeruha, that she had basically an open roof. I imagine this was in the rabbinic period, and I assume in the biblical period, I'm pretty sure mostly roofs were flat. So in this, that's just why the Torah says if you build a house, you have to build a makeh, a fence for your gog. The assumption is that it's a roof that's flat that people can go up on. If you have a slanted roof and nobody can go up there, you don't require a makeh on your roof. But apparently she had roofs that were flat, and apparently there were walls to this roof. There were walls to this roof, but the roof was missing a roof. Right? Imagine the roof of an apartment building. It's very nice up there if it's in perfect weather, but if you want some shelter, you need to put a roof on top of it. So one says that it was an open roof, and she put a covering on top of that for Elisha. V'chad amar, ach sadra gedola haisa, v'chulkuha l'shnayim. One says that, no, it was a very large ach sadra, which is like a porch area, three walls and open on one side. And she put a wall in to divide it, to create space for Elisha. And the word for wall is kir. So the Gemara now says the following. Bishlam alamanda amar achsadra hainu dichsiv kir. If what it means is that she had a room and she put a divider in, then I understand why it says, she said to her husband, nasana alias kir. Elamanda amar aliyah, that it was basically, it was an upper story without a roof. My kir, what does the word kir mean? So the Gemara answers, shekiruha, that they put a roof on it, which is really an interplay between biblical and maybe biblical rabbinic Hebrew, although I can think of at least one instance, maybe two instances, where you do have the meaning of kir, in the sense of a roof. Some of you should probably actually be able to figure out what this one is. Because I think, I could be mistaken, I think you probably said this a few minutes ago. If it means that, it's not entirely clear. I think in Baruch Inafshi it says, HaMekarev HaMayim Aliyosav.
Yeah.
So the simple meaning is that it could be that he put a roof on it. And we also read on Shmini Atzeres and Megillas Koheles, we read, So it sounds like that may also refer to a roof. Okay, but anyway, so instead of reading kir, who the simple meaning of that word certainly is in that form, is a wall, instead it means they put a roof on. And then the Gemara says, but Bishlama Lamanda Amar Aliyah, Hainu dichsiv aliyas, right? She said to her husband, let's make an aliyas kir. So I understand what the aliyah is. It's an upper story. However, Lamanda Omar, Achsadra, my aliyas. What? There's no second story. It's all one story on the ground and you stick a wall in. So the Gemara answers, no. Me'ula shebebatim. This is considered, you know, the nicest of houses. I don't know. I'm not sure why. Maybe in a climate like Eretz Yisrael, so having an open one wall open is really nice because it's nice weather and it gets you more fresh air. Okay. Anyway, so now the Gemara goes on talking about, so again, from tangent to tangent. Now we've explained what the word kir means in this context. So now we're going to talk about the rest of the pasuk and that little story. So the woman says to her husband, Naseno alias kir kitano, vinasim lo sham mita v'shulchan v'chisei umnora. So we'll make him a little room, whatever the room was, and we'll put there a bed, a little table, a chair, a lamp, or candelabra. Whenever Elisha's passing through on his business, on his prophetic business, he'll stay here. Let's be me'areachim. Now, so the Gemara says, V'nasim lo sham mitavu shulchan v'chiseyam nora. Amar Rabbi v'item Rabbi Yitzchak karotze lehanos yehoneh ke'elisha, v'she'ena rotze lehanos al yehoneh kishmuel haramasi. The Gemara here speaks of two models about, let's call it leadership, of whether or not leaders are allowed to take, should be taking things from their followers. Elisha was willing to accept the hospitality of the Shunammis and her husband. Shmuel HaRamasi, Shmuel HaNavi, refused to accept anything. Shenemar, Useshuvo HaRamasa Kisham Beso. So it says by Shmuel, it says he used to go around. He didn't hang out in one place. He used to make the circuit. You know, they talk about a circuit court judge, and I don't know what that means in contemporary language. I don't know, maybe one of the lawyers, Ranan, maybe you can explain, what does it mean to be a circuit court judge?
I don't really know that Ranan's a lawyer.
Yeah, I would defer to Marshall.
Marshall.
Last time I checked, he was a banker.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Although he did go to
Marshall,
law.
I away from you. Yes, what's a circuit court judge?
But he did go to law school, for the record.
Okay.
So it used to be exactly as you are intuiting, that judges rode the circuits. The country was divided into 11 districts called circuits. And in fact, not only district courts, but circuit courts, both levels, rode around and held court in different places because the populace was not able to travel. And as a little historical aside, Abe Lincoln became famous as a lawyer who rode with the circuit and district judges and picked up cases along the way. And very often the district and circuit judges actually shared hotel rooms and even beds with the lawyers. And they were all fast friends as they traveled around the country, dispensing justice and advocating for their clients.
Okay.
CEG, Team of Rivals. Excellent book.
All right. Thank you. So Shmuel was like a circuit court judge. So it says, Shuvaso haramasa kisham beso. So he would return to Ramah because that was his house. So the problem is you have all of these name, all these places that are named. And then it says Kisham Beso. So Rashi comments that, well, of course we know Rama was his bias. We know where he was called Shmuel Ramasi for a reason. We know where he came from. The fact that it says Kisham Beso implies that every place he went, it was Sham Beso. He took his house, meaning his bed, whatever he needed, he always took with him, right? He didn't leave anything. He didn't require anything from anybody else. He didn't want to take anything. So the Gemara says, if you want to be Nana like Elisha, you can. And if not, you can choose not to be Nana like Shmuel. The truth be told, these circumstances are actually two very different circumstances. Because if you think about it, Elisha was not a judge. Well, he's not described as a judge. He was a prophet. He was like the rabbi traveling through. And for him, so you could understand why people might have offered hospitality in exchange, you know, because he's performing a public service. But Shmuel as a judge, was in a position of not wanting to take anything from anybody, because if he took something from somebody, he would be potentially beholden to that person, even if that person was in effect just compensating him, call if you want to call it travel expenses. And the Gemara in Ksubos in the 13th Perek tells a whole series of stories of Amoraim who disqualified themselves from judging for people they knew because they had done them the tiniest of favors, even the situation of things they were entitled to. So what the Gemara tells a story of one Amora whose sharecropper brought him the fruits on Thursday instead of Friday. So he said, what are you here today? So he said, oh, because I have a din Torah. So he said, well, I'm now pasul for you for din. I can't judge you. Why? Because he brought him something that he, a day early, so even for something that small. Or another case of a guy who was in front of a judge and a bird fell, or something fell on his shoulder and he had feathers and he dusted it off. And now the dying said, I can't judge for you because you did something for me. The point being that even the smallest things can change our disposition towards somebody and therefore potentially disqualify someone. So here, Marshall, I'll tell you a story. As you probably remember, I don't know what your opinion was, but some had called on the late Justice Scalia to recuse himself from hearing the case that involved Vice President Dick Cheney because they were hunting buddies. And Justice Scalia said that if you think that the price of buying a Supreme Court justice is that cheap, then we've got bigger problems. And someone in a particular book, I remember the book, I forget the name of the book now, I remember who wrote it, it was about biases, made the point that the issue was not that somebody would take a conscious bribe. It's not that because he's my hunting buddy, therefore I distort the law. The problem is in din, whenever you have to engage in careful judgment, if we may use that term, our sense can be easily distorted even by very small things, can predispose us towards wanting to find one way as opposed to the other. So it would make sense anyway that Shmuel couldn't, but the Marsha here comes along and says that he finds this to be a little difficult, that Elisha, not Shmuel part, but why is it that Elisha was Nana? We find very often in Chazal that they were reluctant to take things from everybody, from other people. The expression is v'sonei matanos yichyeh, the pasuk in Mishle, which whose pshat probably is referring to a judge who doesn't take gifts, who doesn't take bribes. But Chazal always quote that as an idea that there were certain sages who didn't want to take anything. They didn't want to receive anything from someone else because v'sonei matanos yichyeh. In fact, if I recall correctly, I don't know what the answer was, but I think in my Hagasmicha, Rabbi Berman, now president of YU, when he spoke, he quoted a story that someone had approached from Lichtenstein, Zichrono Levracha, whose parents wanted to give him an apartment or something in Israel, whatever else. And he said, on the one hand, it'd be very helpful. On the other hand, but he maybe shouldn't take it because of Sonei Matanos Yechiah. I don't remember what the answer was, but I remember the question.
Nechama Leibowitz was so opposed to any sort of gifts. She was no judge, but she just said,
ma pitom.
Yeah, nechon.
So anyway, so the Marsha says that basically what Elisha was only willing to, he wasn't generally willing to take things from people, but people have a mitzvah of hachnasas orchim. So if Elisha's passing by and someone wants to do basic achnas sarchem, that was something he was willing to accept. To accept gifts, to accept anything beyond that, Marsha points to the example of Gehazi, right? Elisha refused to take anything from Naaman for performing the healing, right? And Gehazi went around his back and, you know, wound up losing his chelik and olam haba for that and for something we're about to see. That was his character. So the Marsha says that even what Elisha was willing to basically, it wasn't that he was willing to take gifts or anything what you might want to call patronage or something of that nature. Okay, so now, once the Gemara is, so Amar Rabbi Yochanan, the Gemara explains, just explaining within Shmuel, shekol makom shehalach, shem beis, shalach shem beiso imo. That's ki shem beiso, wherever Shmuel was, he had the things that he normally would use from his house with him. So I guess he had a portable bed, and whatever else that he needed, so he didn't have to benefit from anybody else. So now the Gemara continues in the story of Gehazi and Elisha. Vatomer el Isha, the woman said to her husband, when she's pushing for him to build this addition, that they should build this addition, hinei no yadati ki ish Elokim kadoshu. So I know that the man of God, which is kind of an interesting expression. And the Gemara is bothered by a very simple question, which is, how did she know he was holy? There is a Gemara in Avodah Zarah we learned a long time ago, and it's quoted in Choshen Mishpat in Siman Chaf Hei, that if you have two rabbis who are arguing about a halacha, and you don't know which one to follow, so halech achar hagadol shebehem, that the first position is whoever is the greater Talmud Chacham. But there is a very basic difficulty, and this is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, but it's a very basic difficulty that I think everybody understands. How do you decide who is the biggest Talmud Chacham? Right? My rabbi is bigger than your rabbi. How do you know who's of greater knowledge? And generally speaking, if you're not an expert in the field or somewhat expert in the field, it's hard for you to evaluate, you know, who is more expert than the other. My friends who work in various fields, in law, in business, tell me when they're involved in a case and then they read the report in the newspaper, most of the time it's clear to them, Marshall, you could weigh in here, that the reporter has no idea what he or she is talking about. Right? They just really don't actually grasp everything. That's a larger question. How do you tell who is a bigger Talmud Chacham? I don't know the answer to that question. I always like to add also is that there are two kinds of expertise needed for paskening a shayla. First, you have to be an expert in Torah. And secondly, you have to be an expert in mitzvahs and understanding the world. And sometimes people possess one expertise, don't possess the other. So figuring out who is the expert is very difficult. By the very same token, how do you decide? How does she know that he's holy? How does she know that he's holy? Generally speaking, if someone shows you his or her behavior, that doesn't tell you anything about the person in most cases, because they might be putting on a show. The way you find out about a person's character is when they think that nobody is looking, that's when you find out. So how does the Isha Shunamis know that he's a Kadosh? So first the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Hanina, from the fact that it's the wife who says to the husband, Mikan shel Isha makeres ba'orchim yoser min ha'ish, that a woman is more perceptive about the guest than the man is, than her husband is. Now, some want to read this, but I don't think that this is pshat. I think the Barsha may say this, that the woman spends more time in the house, so she has a better sense of the guests. I don't think that's actually what's being stated here. I think that there's actually a stereotype being advanced. I'm not telling you that I know that it's true for sure, but the suggestion is that women, this may be along the lines of Bina Yisayu Nasam Beisha, there are certain things that on average, women are more perceptive about. That may be what I can't tell you whether that's true or not, but I think that's actually what the claim Rabbi Yosi Bar Chanina is making, is that women are more perceptive about people's, about the Orchim, about their character. So then the Gemara says, the beginning of the fifth wide line, Kadoshu, he's very holy, he's holy. Mina Yehoda, how did she know? So Rabbi Shmuel Charamar Shelo Rasa Zvuv Over Al Shulchana, that she never saw a fly passing over his table. It means the table where he ate. I want to come back to this and talk about what this means. It's very strange. How does not having a fly around your, you know, in our context, when there are flies at my Shabbos table, it's because someone left the door open to the got in. Right? How does she know? How does she know that a fly, how does this indicate anything? I just want to check. Can people still hear me?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you.
Yes.
We hear you.
Okay. The video is frozen. I want to just make sure that the audio is going. Okay. So, but I, before we talk about that, I want to go to the second one, which is easier to understand. The other one is V'charamar Sadin Shel Pishta Hitzia Amitz Mitaso V'lo Rasa Keri Alav. She would normally put down a linen sheet on his bed, and she never found a seminal mission on it. So she knew that he was, his machshavos were pure. Otherwise, she would have occasionally at least found something on the sheets. Okay, so the second one at least I understand, right? It's something that's not in Elisha's control, and it's an indication of that, at least of what his thought process is, right? Chazal say, and this is true, the person tends to dream about the things he or she thinks about during the day. So that actually makes sense. However, what does it mean that she never saw a fly over his shulchan? How does that indicate any type of kedusha? So the Marshal draws a link, but he doesn't really explain that the Mishnah in Avos, I believe, states that amongst the miracles that were occurred in the Beis HaMikdash is that there was never a Zvuv beVeis HaMitbachayim. There was never, the Beis HaMitbachayim was this area to the north of the Mizbeach. You had these tables probably of marble where they used to chop up the karbanos. And the miracle was with all the meat sitting around there, the meat and animal guts and blood, there was never a fly there. Now the Beis HaMikdash is a very holy place. But what does it have to do with Elisha's shulchan? Right? In the Beis HaMikdash, that was a nes. But what does that mean in the context of Elisha Shochan? So, anybody want to make a suggestion?
He's holy because the same thing happens to him. In other words, no fly would pass his table. It's like a korban. He has that same kedusha.
So I think along those lines, I think actually along those lines, Chazal have an idea when Yechezkel in the future Mikdash is shown the future Mikdash, and he's shown the Mizbeach, and then he says, Zeh ha-shulchan asher lefnei Hashem. This is the shulchan before God. So Chazal asks, what do you mean? It's not a shulchan. It's not the table. It's the mizbeach. It's the altar. So Chazal state that when there's a Beis HaMikdash around, the mizbeach serves as kapara. However, when there's no Beis HaMikdash, shulchanu shel adam is mechaper lav, because you bring in guests and you have them on your shulchan, and that's the way you achieve kapara. So what does that medrash mean? So I think it means that we think we can look at eating and drinking as this mundane activity. We eat and drink because we're hungry, we're thirsty, you know, we saw something delicious, we want to eat it, we have to sustain ourselves. But the suggestion of the Medrash is that no, that actually a person's shulchan should be like a mizbeach. The act of eating and drinking, even though it seems to be mundane, should be regarded as an act of kedusha. We make brachos before, we make brachos afterwards. There's a way we conduct ourselves at a table. So I think that the analogy here being made is that Elisha, the way he behaved on his shulchan, was as if it were like the mizbeach. And by the mizbeach, there were never flies found, and therefore there were never flies found by Elisha Shulchan either. Okay. Now, the Gemara goes on and comments the following. Kadosh, who? Focusing on the word who. She could have just said, you know, Heinish Elokim Aleinu Tamid Kadosh. He's holy. Why does it say Kadosh, who? Okay, that's not the strongest grammatical question. But Amar Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina, who Kadosh? Umisharso eno kadosh. He's holy, but his mishares, who is Gehazi, is not kadosh. Shenemar vayigash Gehazi lahodfa. The Isha Shunamis, after her son dies, comes to Elisha. She has her donkey saddled. She comes to Elisha. She falls at his feet, grabs his feet, and is beseeching him to do something. And Gehazi comes to push her off. Right, he's like one of the groupies almost. He's acting like a groupie. Get him or off the master. And Elisha in the story tells her, "Leave her alone. She's very bitter. There's something wrong, but God hasn't told me what's going on." So, and anyway, Elisha comes to grab her, says, "Lehodfa," to push her aside. Amar Rabbi Yosef ben Chanina, "She'achaza behod yafya," which means literally, he grabbed her by the glory of her beauty. Rashi explains he grabbed her by her breast to cast her off, meaning he was a crude individual. So that's what they comment, Kadoshu, Elisha's Kadosh, the Mishares, not so much. Okay, now they continue interpreting the Pasuk. Over Aleinu Tamid, that's what she said to her husband. We know this Isha Elokim is Kadoshu, and he's Over Aleinu Tamid, he's constantly passing by. Amar Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina Mishum Rabbi Lezer Ben Yaakov, Kol HaMa'areach Tamud Chacham Besoch Beso. Anyone who provides hospitality for Talmud Chacham umehaneu menuchasav and gives hana to the Talmud Chacham from his own assets, it costs somebody to host someone. Mala alava kosuv ilu makriv tamidim. It's like he is bringing a sacrifice, a karban tamid. Now, once the Gemara, so this is the last piece about Elisha and Gehazi. Once the Gemara has said this, now we have statements of Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Hanina, in the name of Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov. So now we just quoted one. Now we quote the Amar Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Hanina, Mishum Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov, Al Yamod Adam b'makom gavoa b'yispalel, El b'makom namach b'yispalel. A person shouldn't stand on a high place in Davin. They should stand on a low, on a place that's low in Davin. In fact, one wonders whether the expression of Yored Lifnei HaTeva, which means to go lead the tzibur, maybe that's related to that. Shenemar mimamakim kirasicha Hashem. We call out to God, and normally we understand this to mean mimamakim means from a very deep place, not spatially, but emotionally, or a very difficult situation. But here it's taken literally. Mimamakim, we call out to God from a physically deep place. Tanya nami hachi, we have a similar, the same idea taught in the Braisa. Lo yamen odam lo al gabe kise, lo al gabe shrafraf. You shouldn't stand on a chair and you shouldn't stand on a footstool. Velo b'mak gavoa, not at any high place, v'yispalo. Ela b'makom namoch v'yispalo. You should daven when you're in a low-lying place. Lefi she'ein gavhus lefnei amakom. In the presence of God, there can be no highness. There can be no haughtiness. Shenemar mimamakim krasich Hashem. And in a similar vein, uchsiv tfilah le'oni kiyatov, which means literally a tfilah for the poor person when he, let's say, wraps himself, prepares himself a tfilah. But Rashi explains tfilah le'oni refers to not who the person is, but the way the person behaves, what the person behaves like during prayer. He behaves like an oni, anius, someone who is low. Then, in a statement that's probably familiar to most of us, even if we didn't know the statement, the halacha is, the Amr Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina, Mishum Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov, Hamispal al tzarach shiyachave nesraglav, Shenemar viraglehem regel yishara. So when a person is davens, a person is supposed to keep one's legs together, so as if you only have one foot. That's viraglehem regel yishara. That their feet, and this is describing the angels in Yecheskel Hanavi's vision of the divine chariot. So their feet of the Sraphim or the Kruvim are Viraglehem Regel Yeshara. And this is actually somewhat interesting. Someone asked me very recently, I think in the last week or so, and I don't remember who asked me, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't in the Shir, why is it that we don't pray prostrate? Now, why don't we pray on the ground? And we very rarely do. We do it when we bow Korim, for those who do it on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And we have to be very careful because you can't be on a stone floor. But they say, why is it that we don't have more of this prayer? And the truth is, in Shlomo's prayer in the Mikdash, right, Shlomo was Korabrikov. He davened to God. He prayed to God in the Mikdash, where you are allowed to bow on a stone floor, it's true. But he's bowed the entire time. Now, the truth is, the halacha does allow, when you or I daven, our Shmon Esrei, you're only allowed to bow at the beginning and the end of the first bracha and at the beginning and the end of Hodah. However, I think a Kohen Gadol can bow at the end of every bracha. It's somewhere later in Maseches Brachas. And a Melech can bow at the beginning and he stays bowed the entire time. The idea, presumably being, is that he's supposed to, the melech of all people needs to be prostrate before God. He, the king, of, more than anyone else, has to humble himself before God. He has to recognize that there's someone above him. But someone asked me, why don't we regularly do that? So I commented that we do have something of prostrate prayer, which is nefilas apayim, colloquially known as tachanun, except for many of you will say to me, but wait, we don't get on the ground of Tachanun. The answer is, we don't get on the ground of Tachanun. But you can see in the Amoraic period, in the Gemara, they did. You daven standing up, and when you were done, you did nefilas apayim fully on the ground. Now, we don't do that anymore. There may be interesting reasons for it, but it occurred to me that there may be another reason, which is that when we daven, we try to emulate the angels. And the angels, Barag Lehem Regli Shor, the angels daven standing up. They daven in a particular way. And we are, at least when we put our legs together, we are imitating that fashion. So it may be that our default mode of prayer is not on the ground because we try to mimic the angels. Maybe. Okay.
I just wanted to add that when I visited Prague, so I actually was asked to daven for the Yomud on Shabbos, whatever it was, Shachris Musaf. So I went over to the Yomud, which was at the front, and sure enough, there was a depression there. It was lower than the floor. And I remember standing in that depression and looking slightly to the right to the kisei where the Maharal sat. And I had that feeling of davening mima amakim.
Okay.
In the Alt Shul, in the Alt Shul.
Yeah, Alt Noi Shul.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Okay.
Rabbi Weider, also the Malachim, it reminds me of we're trying to be so nice to them, although they trip us up so often. It's almost like the like Lamal Shinim, we say it low, you know, meaning that the angels is often talking to Hashem. You know, what are you giving them time for? You know, like, so we're doing the fine thing.
Okay. So now, and what is perhaps the, I would say the most relevant, the one that actually comes up in various contexts, is what, another statement of Amar Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina, Mishum Rabbi Lezer Ben Yaakov, Mai Dichsiv Lo Sochlu Al Adam. Now, just a word about the simple sense meaning, the pshat of the verse. The Torah in Parshas Kedoshim says, Lo Sochlu Al Hadam, Lo Sinach Hashum, Velo Se'onenu. Now, Menachesh and Me'onen, the second and third prohibition in that verse, are clearly practices of divination, of sorcery, magic, divination, something like that. What is Lo Sochlu Al Hadam? So the pshat probably is, it probably is also some type of sorcery or divination. However, Chazal do not interpret this verse this way in any Gemara, any source in Chazal that I'm aware of. And there is a reason for it. The reason is not simply because they might not have known what the practice would have referred to. I don't know, maybe they would have. But because there is a pasuk in Tanakh that raises the possibility of a different meaning. And that pasuk happens to be found in Sefer Shmuel. In Perek Yudalet of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, so Shmuel Shaul basically forbade the people. He imposed an oath upon the people not to eat the entire day. So as you can imagine, when you get to the end of the day, they're all pretty hungry, right? It's not like they were lying on the couch, you know, watching, I don't know, basketball or Star Trek or whatever else somebody might be watching. But rather, they were busy fighting a battle all day. And nonetheless, they didn't eat. Comes the end of the day, and you might imagine the people are hungry. So they grab the booty, and they shecht it. It's in Perek Yudalet of Shmuel Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Beis. It says, "Vayat ha'om el hashalom," the nation, the army, they were like ran after the booty. "Vayichut sonu vakar uvnei vakar," they took animals, "Vayishchatu arza," and they slaughtered it on the ground or towards the ground. "Vayochal ha'om al hadam," and the people ate al hadam, which is exactly what the Torah is prohibiting here. The next verse, they tell Shaul, "Hinei ha'om chotim la'Hashem lachol al hadam." So Shaul says, "Oyve, vayomer begaditem." They're acting treacherously. He tells them, "Roll for me a big stone, like a mizbeach almost." And Shaul says, "Scatter and tell everybody you want to shecht an animal. Bring it to me, and we'll do it right here. And you won't sin to God. Lechol al adam." Now, it's not entirely clear what the people were doing. And if you want to stretch, you could make an argument. Maybe this is something to do with they were engaged in sorcery, but it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense because at the end of the day, there's only one thing that people want to do with these animals, which is eat them. So it sounds like they were rushing the process somehow, which we will see in a few minutes does lead to at least a couple of the interpretations that Chazal offer. But in the meantime, and I don't know that the Gemara actually ever quotes this pasuk to explain why. We're going to see that in a moment after we read our Gemara, which has one interpretation. The Gemara in Sanhedrin has four interpretations. I don't think the Gemara, maybe I was wrong. I don't think the Gemara in Sanhedrin doesn't quote the pasuk in Shmuel, which is interesting, but it clearly knows the pasuk. So firstly, what is probably the most famous interpretation, but I'm going to spill the beans a little bit. This is the one interpretation that's almost certainly midrabbanan. It's only rabbinic in nature. It's just an asmachta. The four that we're going to see in Sanhedrin are actually dinim d'oraisa, and we'll explain about them. But right now, am Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina Mishum Rabbi Eliezer Ben Yaakov. May dichtiv lo sochlu al adam, lo sochlu kodem shetispalalu al dimchem. You're not allowed to eat until you pray over your own soul. And this is the source that you're not allowed to eat before you daven in the morning. Now, generally speaking, you're not allowed to eat before davening. For example, mincha time comes. This is complicated in our circumstances, but in principle, let's say when mincha ketana comes, at least, when you get to the end of the ninth hour, at the beginning of the ninth hour of the day, so the beginning of the 10th hour of the day, the end of the ninth hour, mincha ketana, half an hour before, you're not supposed to sit down to eat. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't have a drink. It doesn't mean that you can't munch on some grapes. No, that you can do. You're not allowed to sit down for a suda kavua or a fixed meal. In the same way, whenever you have a mitzvah that's come due, you're not allowed to start to sit and eat a meal before until you do the mitzvah. In principle, that's what halach. It's a mishnah in Shabbos and Daf Yud, in the first parak. But here, the Gemara is going beyond that. This is not just about eating a meal before Shacharis. As we'll see in a second, is clear from the next line in the Gemara. This seems to be a special prohibition, albeit rabbinic, about eating before davening in the morning. Before mincha, before marv, you want to have a snack, that's fine. You want to grab a granola bar, it's fine. You want to grab an apple, it's fine. Before Shacharis, it's not fine. And the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Yitzchak, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Chanina, Mishum Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Kala Ochel v'shosev, Achar Kach Mispala, anyone who eats and drinks and then davens, all of our kasav omer, v'osi hishlachta acharei gavecha. God says, you threw me behind your back. Al tikri gavecha elageecha. You threw me behind your pride. And what does this mean? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, la'achar shenisgazeh, after he became prideful, then kibol amachu shamayim. Now, it's a little bit, it's kind of, you know, it's hard to understand what exactly is being spoken about here. One thing is clear that we'll see when we look at the Shulchan Aruch, either now or maybe next week, is that it's not about someone who can function, who's hypoglycemic and needs to eat something because they can't focus because they're so hungry or they're so thirsty. I mean, someone, you know, before he davens, let me sit back, let me have a cup of coffee, let's relax, let's have a conversation. That's osi hishlachta acharei ge'echa. Right? After he sort of sits there with a certain degree of, call it gaiva if you want, then now he's ready to be mekabel amach shamayim. One of the interesting things about this, by the way, is that in the second formulation is kabbalas amach shamayim, which doesn't refer to tefillah technically, it refers to kriya shema. Okay. But before we actually focus on this halacha, as it will appear in Shulchan Aruch, I wanted to spend a little time looking at Lo Sochel Al Hadam. As I said to you a few moments ago, this when you read a Gemara like this, it does sort of jump off the page at you that this is not a real drasha. It's an asmachta. Like Lo Tochlu Kodem Shetispalu Al Dimchem. It seems, I could be wrong, but my sixth sense would have told me that this was an asmachta. On the source sheet that was distributed, Lenny, that was sent out? Okay. So on the source sheet, I first bring for you the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Now, just an interesting backdrop to the Gemara in Sanhedrin. When a person violates a negative commandment of the Torah, a mitzvah lo sasei, we say that the default punishment is lashes, is malchus. But in order to get malchus for a negative prohibition, there—I don't want to say there are four criteria that have to be met—but there are four categories of negative commandments that are excluded from the punishment of Malchus as a rule. The paradigm for the punishment of Malchus is the losase that is found immediately after the parsha of Malchus in the Torah. The Torah in Parshas Kisetze says, V'haya im bina kos harasha, if the person deserves Malchus, they give him Malchus, they give him 40 lashes, they're not allowed to hit him more than 40 lashes, lest he be humiliated. The very next verse is, Lo sachsom shor bidisho. You may not thresh an ox, you may not muzzle an ox when threshing, right? You put the ox, they would have the animal stomp on the grain to break apart the kernels from the chaff. You're not allowed to muzzle the ox when doing that. In fact, it's cruel to the animal. So Chazal understand that there are four characteristics of what they call lav dachasima, the negative prohibition of being chosem, of chasima being chosem ashore. Number one, it has to be a lav sheish b'maisa. It has to be an act of violation. You put a muzzle on the animal, that's something you do. Number two is it cannot be a lav hanitak lase. It can't be a lav which you can fix subsequently. So for example, this is a machlokas, but some say, if you take the eggs or the fledglings without sending away the mother bird, so one opinion is that you don't get lashes for taking the mother bird because you can still for taking the eggs or the fledglings because you can still send away the mother bird, so you can fix what you did wrong. It's a lav hanitak lase, the more classic lav hanitak lase. But it has a second complication, which is it's passive, is allowing meat of a carbon to become nosar, right? Lo sosir mimenu ad boker, but v'hanosar mimenu ad boker ba'esh tisrofu. That's the classic lav anita klase, but it also happens to be a passive lo sase. So number one, it has to be active. Number two, it can't be nita klase. Number three, it has to be formulated in the negative prohibition. The negative language. The Torah has many cases where the Torah tells us to do something, where it's not telling us to do something, it's telling us not to do something. So when the Torah says, most Rishonim understand, when the Torah says, take interest from a non-Jew, l'anachri sashich, and the Sifrei says, it's a mitzvah saseh, almost all the Rishonim, I think, except for the Rambam, understand, it's not a mitzvah saseh if you lend money to a non-Jew that you have to charge interest. It's another way for the Torah repeating and emphasizing that if you want to take interest, you may do it with a guy, but not from a Jew. L'nachri sashich says, if you may going to take interest only from a guy, which is another way of saying you may not take interest from a Jew. So that's what's called a lav haba michlal asay, a lav which is inferred from a mitzvah asay. Finally, and the one that's relevant here, the fourth category is what's called a lav shebichlalus, which has two different meanings. I'm only going to explain what it means here. Here it means you have a lav which is one losase, but it has multiple meanings unrelated to one another. And therefore, that's called a kind of a lav shebichlalus. It's a very losase. It's not specific enough, and therefore you don't get malchus at all for it. So now the Gemara is going to describe this as a lo sokol adam as an example of lav shebichlalus, and it's going to cite four different interpretations of it. D'tanya, this is source number one. I mean, kodem shetetze nafsha.
Could you pull up the sheet on the screen, Rabbi?
I guess I can share it. Hold on, I got to first bring. Give me one moment to bring it up. I got to open it.
Josh, you want me to send it to you?
Larry, I just about have it. I just want to make sure that when you see it, I can read it too. Okay.
I have it somewhere. I just didn't print it. I can print it if
I got it. Here we go. I just. Okay. D'tanya, source number one. Minayin la'ochel min ha'behema kodem sheteitze nafsha shehu belosase. How do you know that if you slaughter an animal, but it's still moving, right? In other words, it's having whatever reflexes it has. How do you know that before it's totally dead and you eat from it, you violate a losase? Lo sochlu al hadam. You're not allowed to eat Al Hadam, which, by the way, this one, perhaps more than any of the other interpretations, looks like it's coming from Sefer Shmuel. Right? This would make sense. They were so hungry, they would slaughter the animal right where they were, and they immediately dig into the animal. So Shaul said, bring the karbanos here. By the time they took their animal back to their spot, the animal would have been totally dead. Dovar acher. No, maybe there's a different prohibition. Lo sochlu al hadam, lo sochlu basar v'adayin dam b'mizrach. This is a prohibition which is specific to a karbon. This might have been, but I doubt it, what was going on in the story in Shmuel. A kohen, they shech the karbon. The kohen receives the blood in a kli and a mizrach, and you have to throw it on the mizbeach. So you're not allowed to eat any part of the karbon until you throw the blood. Because if the blood isn't thrown on the mizbeach, the karbon's not kosher, and of course you're not allowed to eat the meat. But even though you eventually throw the blood on the mizbeach, there's a losase of eating the basar when the dam is still in the mizrach. The blood hasn't been thrown on the mizbeach. Number three, Rabbi Dosa. I'm sorry, there are actually four, but these two are, they're going to be five. Rabbi Dosa Omer, minayin she'in mavrin al haruge beisdin, Talmud lomar lo sochlu al hadam. We have a minhag that when avelim begin avelus, when they go back home from the cemetery, we bring them a meal. It's called the Sudas Havra'ah. It first occurs in Tanakh probably by after Avner's death, when the people came to feed David, even though he wasn't Avner's relative. So we have this idea of a Sudas Havra'ah, that the first Suda that the Avel eats on the day of the burial, he's not allowed to eat of his or her own food, but rather others must feed them. So, how do you know that you may not have a Sudas Havra by a person who died because the Beis Din executed him? The answer is Lo Sochlu Al Hadam. In a related but slightly different vein, Rabbi Akiva Omer, Minayin L'Sanhedrin Shehargu Esanefesh, Sh'ein Toamim Klum Kol Oso Hayom. How do you know that if a court sentences someone to death and executes them, that they must fast that entire day to impress upon themselves the seriousness of what they're doing? Talmud lomar lo sochlu al adam. And finally, one last one, Rabbi Yochanan Omer, azhara leben sorer umore minayin. Talmud lomar lo sochlu al adam. Rabbi Yochanan is suggesting the following. We have a rule that the Torah never gives a punishment unless it gives a warning. Lo anash akasav ela imkein hizir. Now, this seems to be sort of more of a meta-philosophical principle of Chazal, because sometimes very often the Torah tells us not to do something, and it also tells us what the punishment is. Sometimes the Torah just tells us not to do something, and it doesn't tell us the punishment, and by losaseis, the default tends to be malchus. On rare occasions, the Torah will tell you something without actually having a formal place for the warning. In other words, the Torah will say, if you do so-and-so, you get put to death. But it doesn't say, or it's not clear, where does it say you're not allowed to do it? Now, if you asked me, I am my own would have said it's very simple. If God tells you, if you do X, you get the death penalty, I can intuit that on my own, that I'm not supposed to do it. But Chazal felt strongly there always has to be a place where you can find the Azara. So we have a Ben Sora Umora who's put to death, not even clear for what. For what that he's actually done. So how do you know you're not allowed to become a Ben Sora Umora? I mean, it's a kind of a strange thing. You know, a bar mitzvah boy, right after his bar mitzvah, in his 3-month window of eligibility for becoming Ben Sora Mora, he comes to you and says, you know, I was thinking about becoming a Ben Sora Mora, but is that also a mota? Well, you tell him we're going to kill you if you do that. Obviously, he doesn't need to ask that question, but Chazal would like there to be somewhere in the Torah a pasuk that warns against it. So they say, Ashar la Ben Sora Mora minayin, Talmud lomar lo sochlu al adam. Don't eat in a way that will cause your blood to be shed.
And a Ben Sora Mora
is punished because he is a dolel v'soveh. He's a glutton and a drunkard. But because of his eating, is at least the precipitating event of his being executed. So that's what lo sochlu al hadam means.
Hey, Rabbi Weider.
Yes.
Apologies. Someone did not go back on mute, and there's a lot of feedback the last few minutes. The request for the sources. So if everyone could look at their screens and go back on mute, that would be great.
Okay. Well, we got it, so I think we're good. Let me bring this up again. Okay. So then the Gemara...
That's very powerful. that this is related to that. Very powerful. Solar aroma. Unbelievable. Go ahead.
Amar Rabbi Abin Bar Chia, v'itema Rabbi Abin Bar Kahana, al kulam eino loke mishum dahaven le'lav shebechlalos. But you don't get malchus for any of these because it's one lav that has so many different meanings, all of which, by the way, are assumed to be Torah prohibitions, but you don't get malchus because it's lav shebechlalos. There are actually six interpretations in the Gemara, five here, all of which I think are taken as Yisurim Daraisa. I'll comment a little bit more on that just for a moment. And then the one in Brachos, which I think is not assumed to be Midaraisa, the Rambam will quote all of these Isurim with some kind of a losase, but he does not quote losochel adam when he talks about not eating before davening. And I think it's generally assumed to be what we call an asmachta. It's not a real drasha. Okay. I guess the truth is I'm not going to say anything further about these prohibitions. Let's turn our attention now to how this is cited in halacha, and this actually comes up very, very much halacha lemaisa. The Tor in Or HaChaim, that is source number 2, writes the following: Bekosav Aviho Ezri. Sorry about that. I'm trying to get the Avi Ezri is the Rav Yoh, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yoel HaLevi, who was one of the German Pietists, probably 12th century, I think. Shemutar lishtos mayim, you're allowed to drink water before davening. The lo shayich behu gaiva, drinking water. Nobody sits around. You know, I'm not sure he ever met us today. Today, you can spend a lot of money on water. You can buy very fancy waters. But once upon a time, you drank water because you were thirsty. That was it. Vidavka, however, the Rabbi Yoh said, bichol avo b'shabes v'yom tov kasav, the asur mishum hakiddush. So this is very interesting, and I always am careful about this when I deal with bar mitzvah boys, when I've taught bar mitzvah boys. The Rav Yoh says you're not allowed, the Gemara says you're not allowed to eat or drink. You can't even drink before Kiddush. You're not allowed to drink water before Kiddush. You can't be toim anything. So the Rav Yoh says you want to drink water before davening. It's fine as long as it's not Shabbos or Yom Tov. By Shabbos or Yom Tov, because it's the midst of Kiddush, you're not allowed to drink before. But the Torah continues, Va'adoni Abizal, which is the Rush, the Torah's father, Hayashose Mayim B'Shabbos B'Boker Kodem Tfila, he would drink before davening. She'ein HaKiddush Osro. Yes, you're not allowed to drink before davening, before you make Kiddush, but that's only if you're able to make Kiddush. But Kiddush doesn't ask you from drinking, Kevan She'adayin Lohigi Azmano. Once you're able to make Kiddush, and you cannot make Kiddush before you tefillah on Shabbos morning, one, before you're able to make Kiddush, there's no prohibition of drinking whatsoever. It's only after you make Kiddush. Then, only after you daven. Once you've daven, now the chiv of Kiddush of the day sets in, and now you're not allowed to eat or drink anything until you make Kiddush. We're not talking about someone who's about to kill over and die. We're not talking about Pikuach Nefesh. But it means I'm thirsty. Doesn't matter. You're not allowed to drink till you have Kiddush. Now, what I always do for bar mitzvah boys is I always tell them to bring a little bottle of a grape juice with them. And right after Shacharis, because they might want to drink during the Kriyas HaTorah. So if they want to drink before Shacharis, it's not a problem. But that's not when they want to drink. They want to drink a little bit of a drink between the aliyos, because they're thirsty, because their throat is dry, whatever it is. So what I tell them to do is bring along a little thing of grape juice and make Kiddush right during Chazaras HaShatz, and then you have your bottle of water with you. And then when you want to drink, you can drink. So I realize people don't always think about it, aware of it, and they want to be helpful. But the right thing to do would be, as part of chinuch and teaching the halacha, would be to say, make sure you make Kiddush before. We can arrange that. It's not so difficult. Okay. Anyway. So that's what the Torah quotes a machlokas about this issue. And the psak halacha, as we'll see, happens to be that, yes, you're allowed to drink on Shabbos morning before you daven Shacharis. It's only once you daven Shacharis, now the chi of Kiddush sets in, and now you have to make Kiddush if you want to drink. Okay.
I think it's a great thing to teach the kids this halacha, because it's really, it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. But you should also teach them that in the olden days, nobody brought a bottle of water to Kriyas HaTorah. They managed to read the whole, whatever they had to do, without stuff.
It's true, but Rabbi Lichtenstein, Niskatnu HaDoros. Niskatnu HaDoros.
Niskatnu, got it.
Okay. So then there is another machlok, an interesting machlokas here as well, which is Vim Hischil, the Torah continues, Vim Hischil Lechol, Kodem Alos HaShachar, Kosav HaRambam Zal Shein Tzarech LaHafsek. Let's say you started eating at 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, I don't like to be hungry when I'm davening. So, okay, that's fine. So just get up very early in the morning before you can possibly daven. It's pitch blackout and you start to have, your suda. And now daybreak comes. Do you have to be mafsik? We're not talking about if you're not going to have the time to daven. We mean Alos HaShachar comes. Davening is not until, Hanitzacham or sometime later. Do you have to stop? The Rambam says no. The Rambam says it's like other tfilos. But Vadoni Avizal Kosav Bishemri Shetzarech Lahafsek. But my father, the Rush, in the name of the Ribalatosa, said that you have to be Masik. The question is, why do you have to be Masik? In other words, the Rambam's din we understand. The Rambam says this is just like Mincha. When you start your meal, you're not allowed to start mincha, let's say a meal, by the end of the ninth hour and onward. But let's say you started eating lunch at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and you're enjoying yourself, and you have another course and another course, and now comes the end of the ninth hour. Now you have plenty of time to daven mincha. A mincha at KJ is called for 15 minutes or 10 minutes or 12 minutes before shkia. Not a problem. You're going to daven mincha there. You're even sitting in the room. You're sitting in the social hall right next to the sanctuary. So I'm not concerned. So the halacha is you can continue eating. You started to eat behetah, you may continue to eat behetah. So the question then is, well, then why? I understand the Rambam's position. By Shachris, the same thing. You're not allowed to eat. You can't start eating before Shachris. You're not allowed to eat at all before Shachris. But if you started eating before Alos HaShachar, the Rambam says you don't have to stop. And the Rush says, no, Tzarech LaHafsek. The question is why. I think I'm going to keep everybody in suspense till next week. If you're really curious, you can read on in the sources. But next week, we'll finish up this topic, and we will move on in the Gemara. Are there any questions for the moment?
Okay. I would like to add that at 5 in the morning Friday, I got up to hear Dr. Halevi from Shari Tzedek do the Breshit through Chovaveh, which was a lovely thing. It's an uptick there, so people aren't going to shul again. It was beautiful. And let me ask you a question. How do you explain to a child that Hashem gave them leather jackets on Perek Gimel to Chava and Adam? Leather kutanot, whatever kutanot, and the dikduk is perfect kutanot. I mean, it's fascinating. We gave them kutanot shel or.
Kutanot shel
or. Right.
Kutanot.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah. Some people have a been,
I can only say I'm sure that they were very well made.
Yes. Yes. And Rabbi Meir Balhanes in his chumash, it said kutanot shel or with an olive.
Yes.
And that was so Mavrik in Gan Eden. Mavrik in Gan Eden. Right?
I'm going to stop the recording, but I'll tell you something about that.